From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, some sobering information about efforts to protect the most vulnerable people from the threat of lead-tainted water.
We've kind of continued to let children be exposed to lead, despite knowing all the negative consequences of that exposure.
Later, whether it's an Olympic figure skater or a toddler just taking the ice, we'll learn about the difference a good skate sharpening can make.
And we'll have an in-studio conversation and performances from Milwaukee musicians Kaylee Conway and Marielle Alschwang.
So I've been playing out in Milwaukee for probably like 8 or 9 years or something. And, you know, it's taken about that long, but now I feel like I know everyone.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Leaders in Milwaukee continue to grapple with how to address the challenges of lead-tainted water. The crisis has again come to a head with a forced departure of the city's health commissioner in recent days.
Last summer, the Pew Charitable Trusts issued a massive childhood lead exposure report. Now, a group called Child Trends has streamlined Pew's findings and have tried to make the data more accessible online. The organization hopes the overview will capture the attention of policymakers around the country at every level of government and help initiate lead removal programs.
The data could be especially key here in Milwaukee as the city looks to rectify missteps in handling its HUD-supported lead paint abatement program and deal with at least 70,000 lead pipes supplying drinking water into homes.
Research scientist Vanessa Sack co-authored Child Trends' piece called The United States Can and Should Eliminate Childhood Lead Exposure. She talked about it with Lake Effect's Susan Bentz.
The message is that there's no single approach to take to address lead. It really depends on what are the key sources of exposure in a particular community, maybe even in a neighborhood. And so there's no sort of one-size-all intervention that or approach to preventing lead exposure that might work for every community. And so that's why there's so many different approaches highlighted in the report, because it's important to keep in mind that there's a lot of different effective ways to tackle this issue.
The point is made in the overview that while the U.S. has made strides, we lag behind other countries in reducing the sources of lead. And equally as important, you know, children exposed to lead at any level, whether they are tested and found to have a what is considered to be below that EPA action level, or not, can face developmental and learning deficits that are with them for life.
Yes, that's right. No level of lead has been deemed safe for children. Lead is a toxic substance that can cause neurologic damage, and that can have effects throughout a lifetime.
So circling back to the aim of the work that you're doing, you're hoping that this piece, let's call it, will be something that grabs the attention of everybody from policymakers from local to the federal level and advocacy groups that want to have sort of the facts behind their concern about lead. Do you think this can make a difference?
Yeah, I think, as I said, this is definitely a solvable problem. I mean, there's a lot of public health issues that we don't know how to solve, and we know what it takes to get rid of lead and to prevent lead exposure. And we also have some idea about what is helpful for children who have already been exposed to potentially mitigate some of those negative effects of lead that we've talked about.
I'd love to have you jump into that. What are things that can be done that have, in how effective are they?
So some things that can be done are really providing high quality early care and education programs. We looked at a variety of different kinds of evidence-based interventions in the report. So we don't single out any one particular program as being, you know, the effective program for children who have been exposed to lead, but instead we kind of looked across you know, a variety of high-quality programs. And what we saw is that they that has the potential to reduce teen births among this population, to increase high school graduation rates among children who have been exposed to lead, and to ultimately increase their lifetime income.
Are you saying that with programs that are designed for children who have been impacted by lead at either low or higher levels from early childhood on, that kind of attention is important to the lives of those children?
Yeah. What we saw in our work for this report was that providing these kinds of interventions in early childhood, as well as when a child has moved into middle childhood, has a potential for the largest boost of these more positive outcomes or reducing negative outcomes. So if you were to enroll children who have been exposed to lead in programs throughout their sort of early and middle childhood, we would expect to see greater gains in terms of their positive outcomes or reductions in their negative outcomes than we would if they were just had an intervention in early childhood versus middle childhood. I should say that there's not been a lot of research around these interventions for children who have been exposed to lead specifically, but we know that lead affects children in a very similar way to the way that traumatic experiences and poverty and some other disadvantages affect children. And so all the programs that we looked at have all been part of a rigorous evaluation for children in those kinds of populations. And so we think that they would probably work the same way for children who have been exposed to lead.
Are there impacts of lead that lead has on a child's brain and development that are unique that parents and educators, people watching out for our societies, is there more to be learned about the arc of lead exposure in a child's life?
You know, lead has been around for a really long time, and I think we pretty well understand at this point what it does to a child's brain and to their body and the ways in which that then manifests itself in their behavior. I think there's a lot of room for increased screening of children and more consistent blood lead testing of children, and that's something we talk a little bit about in the report. So while I don't know that there's a lot more that we need to know necessarily about what lead does to children, I think there's a lot more that we can do in terms of responding to it.
Would Child Trends bottom line in what the organization hoped can be achieved for kids just born and growing up in the U.S., that there would be a sort of three-prong approach of testing of children, early intervention, and then at the same time come up with strategies for comprehensive removal of lead risks, again, paint, water, and some of the other exposures that kids can have through household items and so forth, which is also mentioned in the report. Is it really, though, that full picture that you're hoping to encourage and show that there are tools to achieve those things?
Yeah, I think our goal is to highlight the reality that addressing lead exposure in the U.S. is not a complete story, and that it's especially a problem for low-income and minority children, and that a focus on eliminating lead exposure could have really important positive effects on school success and behavior and later life success among children who are exposed. I think, as you said, their prevention of any and removal of sort of sources of exposure are extremely important, as well as providing these evidence-based interventions for children who have already been exposed.
When you consider the range of your analysis of various youth development issues, what strikes you about lead?
I think it's really that, I mean, as you said, it's a very solvable issue. I think it's also that we just are so already aware of how toxic it is to children, and that we still haven't actually had that lead us to removing all the sources of exposure. So we've kind of continued to let children be exposed to lead despite knowing all the negative consequences of that exposure.
Vanessa Sack is a research scientist with the Maryland-based organization Child Trends. You'll find a link to its report called The United States Can and Should Eliminate Childhood Lead Exposure at WUWM.com.
Sack spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz, and you can find more of her coverage of the lead crisis in Milwaukee at our website as well.
Given the previous lead crises in places like Washington, D.C. and Flint, Michigan, Milwaukee's challenges shine a light on the troubles we sometimes have learning from struggle. Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler reflects on that lesson as well.
They say we learn more from our mistakes than our successes. And if the failure is really painful, the lesson is never forgotten. Maybe that's why I can still recall the pain from an incident in 1950 when I was all of about 8 years old. Back then, Dad decided it was time for me to get my first allowance, 2 dimes a week, one to spend and the other to save. Well, I heard the spend part, but ignored the save part, blowing the whole 20 cents on candy. When Dad found out I spent the dime to be saved, he made me take the 10 cents worth of candy back to the store, then get my dime back and put it in the piggy bank. Wow, cruel, mean, heartless, right? At the time, you bet. Talk about pain. But with age comes understanding, if not wisdom. And that was a lesson necessary to be taught and necessary to be learned. You see, Dad and Mom both came of age at the bottom of the Great Depression. They were forced to deal with the economic wreckage that was the 1930s, as the reckless money habits of the 1920s came home to roost, buying stock with 10% down and 90% debt, spending every dollar one made because boom times would last forever. Well, the boom busted in the 1930s. Many formerly middle-class families walked away from their heavily mortgaged and foreclosed homes with little more than the shirt on their back. There were plenty of sellers for everything, but no buyers for anything. I remember a picture I saw someplace of a sign in a car window. It said, 1928 Cadillac for sale. Make me an offer. Under the block letters was a handwritten scrawl. Make me any offer, it pleaded. Dad graduated from high school in 1931, just as the unemployment rate hit 25%. He then began looking for his first job, a much more painful experience than taking back 10 cents worth of candy. At one company, the owner pointed to his staff and said to Dad, "Here are my 5 employees. All married men with families. Which one should I fire so I can hire you, kid?" How's that for painful? Finally, of course, he got a job, a wife, and a house, and by the late 1930s, things began to improve. But the lessons of those years stayed with him all his life. Every car was a cash deal. Buy on time? Never. A dollar down, a dollar when you catch me, he called it. Dad was deathly afraid of debt. He never owned a share of stock or a corporate bond, preferring only U.S. government-backed CDs. All his overtime pay during World War II went to pay off the mortgage early or to U.S. government war bonds. Now can we see why that dime had to go in my piggy bank? If you're like me and on the older side of 65 or so, we join together as the last of the kids of Depression-era parents. Yes, our kids and grandkids probably think our money habits are a little strange. And they're right. I don't know about you, but for me, the lessons of thrift, the danger of too much debt, and the need to save for the inevitable rainy day started with 10 cents worth of candy, and it never left. And Dad, that is a debt I can never repay.
Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who lives and writes in Brookfield.
The struggles are real for figure skaters in competition, especially if their skates are not cooperating. We'll learn the fine art of skate sharpening when Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tonight, Milwaukee time, the best male figure skaters in the world will begin to compete for Olympic medals. The men's individual short program takes the ice now that the pairs competition has concluded. For millions of Americans, this is the one time every 4 years that figure skating comes into focus.
But for some, including many people in Milwaukee, figure skating is a weekly or even daily pursuit. You can find an affordable used pair of skates or spend hundreds of dollars on high-end skates. But regardless of your skills or the model of your skates, there is one requirement. They need to be sharp. It turns out that the craft of skate sharpening is not as simple as you might imagine.
Both of my kids are figure skaters, so I grabbed their skates and headed to a house in the far southern reaches of Milwaukee, where I visited Bob Beyer in his basement workshop. Beyer walked us through how he gets a pair of blades really sharp and how he got into the field in the first place.
When I first started skating, and I started later in life, so I was an adult, my instructor was my skate sharpener. So he's all I ever knew for skate sharpening. As luck would have it, he was very good. So whenever I needed skates done, I gave them to him. He brought them back. I skated. That's all I ever knew. Unfortunately, after maybe 4 or 5 years, he left and went to a skating show. And when he was gone, I took it to the local shop. I didn't know, you know, didn't really think much about it. I just took it to this guy, and he sharpened them. And my skating started to deteriorate, so I ended up actually quitting skating for several years just because I felt like I wasn't progressing. I ended up going back probably about 6-7 years later, and as luck would have it, again my old coach had then just come back. So I was skating, I gave him my skates to sharpen, he sharpened them, I went out on the ice and I went, "You gotta be kidding me, what did you do?" There was such a drastic difference. And being an adult, you know, you might think about these things. Kids certainly don't think about it. But it was right then and there that I knew how important a good sharpening was. Because he told me right there, he said, "Well, you had to be having trouble with this and this and this." And I went, "Yeah, absolutely." And he said, "Well, your skates were sharpened very poorly." About 2 years after that, I gave him my skates to sharpen, and he said, "Well, you've got to get somebody else to do it because I'm not doing it anymore." And my first comment was, "You can't quit. I need you." And he said, "Well, I'm quitting." He said, "If you know anybody that wants to buy my equipment, let me know." And I said, right then, I said, "How much do you want for it, and will you show me how to use it?" And I bought it right on the spot.
How long ago was that?
Oh, gosh. 25, 30 years ago, probably, at least.
So when people watch figure skating during the Olympics or whenever, we sometimes hear about the different parts of a skate blade. But, you know, for people who only see it then, can you give us a quick walkthrough on what you're actually working on here, the different parts of the blade?
Well, for sharpening, basically all you're doing is putting the edges on the bottom of the blade. Actually, you put a hollow. It's called a radius of hollow down the middle, and it's very important that that is down the middle, not off to one side or another. If it's off to one side or another, it creates more of a bite angle on one side than the other, and therefore you have problems skating. So the hollow needs to be definitely right down the middle so that both edges, the inner and outer edges, have the same bite into the ice.
And I think people will be surprised to realize that the bottom of the it's not the entire bottom of the blade that's really touching down on the ice. You're really working on the edges.
Very definitely. In fact, if you think about it, a blade is very straight, obviously, but it has a radius. It's called rocker radius, which is part of the design of the blade so that you can go around tight circles so that you can go in those directions without getting stuck. If the blade sinks in too far, you actually would get stuck in your own tracing or your own rut as you went around a circle. And that actually can happen if the edges are too sharp or they're too crisp and too deep.
Which, again, I think will surprise people that there's you don't want it too sharp.
Yeah, well, that's true. There's a certain amount. I mean, if you think about it, your daughter, for example, how much does she weigh? Myself weighing 200 plus, we won't go into that, but, you know, obviously with the same amount of bite, I'm going to sink into the ice a lot farther than she is because I'm a lot heavier. So for someone my size, I can't give the same hollow as somebody that's her size.
Do you also sharpen a blade depending on what a skater's specialty is, whether they're about footwork or jumps or something else?
Well, yes, to a degree, but not so much as far as what they're doing, more the level that they're at doing it. So somebody that's doing double or triple jumps, they require, you know, really good edges to take off from and land on. As I just said, as far as myself being bigger, well, as your daughter gets bigger, she gets better. But as she gets bigger, scientifically speaking, she needs less hollow and less bite angle because she's getting heavier and she's going to sink into the ice more. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. I shouldn't say unfortunately, it just doesn't, because of the fact that the skater is getting better, and because they're getting better, they actually usually need more hollow because they need those edges to take off and land on.
So this attention to things like hollow, this is what distinguishes what you do from someone who just brings their skates to the guy that sharpens at the rink.
Very true. For the most part, if you generally go to a rink and or any place and you give them your skates, first thing that you should look for as a skater is, are they going to ask you anything? I've seen, you know, very small people with very big feet and vice versa. So the size of the boots has really no relevance as to the ability of the skater. You definitely need to know what the skater is working on, what their ability level is, what they're looking for. Some people also like sharper skates, some like less sharp skates. It really depends on the individual as to what they're looking for. But when you go into any place to get your skates done, hopefully the person there asks you something about whose skates are these. Are they yours? Are they your daughter's? Is your daughter, you know, somebody that's going on the ice for the first time? Or is she Gracie Gold, you know, a national competitor? So you have to know these things, otherwise you can't really do the sharpening justice.
So we mentioned my daughter. You have one of my daughter's skates on your jig right now.
Yes.
Can you walk me through what you're doing?
Sure. Well, the first thing is, as skaters skate, they get nicks on the side or on the edges of the blade occasionally. So the first thing I do is I take those edges off, or those little nicks and bumps. For the most part, the nicks don't really hurt you that much unless they're coming out the side, where it would create drag. So when you're on the ice, if you were on that particular portion of the blade and something is sticking out the side, it's going to create drag. Anybody that's done a 4-minute program can tell you it takes a lot of energy. So you don't want to have to exert more just because of something like that.
And you take off the nicks with what?
Just a stone, a millstone, just to basically get it so that it's smooth on the sides. Next step is after that, then it's, again, depending on what I know about the skater, then I look for what kind of hollow I'm going to put into the bottom of the blade. So then I have to dress the wheel accordingly to get a specific hollow into the blade.
And what you did there, you're effectively calibrating the sharpener.
Essentially, yes. All I'm doing is putting a radius onto the stone that's going to sharpen the wheel. And this is all done with a graduated scale over here, so you set it to wherever, whatever hollow that you want to put into the blade.
Okay. notice as you slide the blade along the stone, every once in a while you stop and you kind of touch the blade every so often. What are you feeling for?
Basically, when you sharpen any metal or grind any metal, you get a burr on the edge. When I get that burr on the edge, I know that I've actually gotten to the edge. So until then, I really am not doing anything. So I'm feeling for that burr to make sure that I have gotten both to the sides of each side, the bottom and the top, or the inside and outside edge. Then after that, I check the blade for squareness. I have a precision square that I use, and to make sure that the edges are square so that you have the same bite angle on the inside and the outside edge. And unfortunately, it doesn't work so that you do it one time and it's perfect. So you have to adjust it, and then you just keep adjusting it until everything is square and the edges are good. And once I've got it to that point, which it is right now on this particular boot, then I put the finishing touches on it, which is a polish. And what that does is it gets rid of all of the chatter on the bottom of the blade that comes from just sharpening. And that takes out, it helps the skater with their flow so that when they're out there skating, they don't need to push as hard to get a little more of a result. And it's all saving energy, basically, is what it amounts to. And the skaters tend to like that.
In an ideal world, should a figure skater notice if their blades have just been sharpened?
In an ideal world, yes, they will notice it. But the only difference should be more confidence and security being on the blades, just because they're sharpened and you have better edges. So you're just going to be more confident because you're going to be able to land those jumps that maybe yesterday you were falling on. The biggest old wives' tale is never get your skates sharpened right before you compete or right before you test, because you never know what you're going to get. And for the most part, that is very true, unfortunately, because there are, unfortunately, again, not that many skate sharpeners that really know what they're doing. Therefore, you get differences all the time. If they raise an edge or lower an edge or get a totally different hollow, you need to get used to that again, where if you know your skate sharpener and it's always the same, it never is going to change. As long as if you like it today, you're going to like it tomorrow. You're just going to be more secure on those edges.
So if Bob Beyer is sharpening your skates, it's okay to get him sharpened the day before a competition.
Well, I hope so. I am human. I do make mistakes, but
For
the most part, I've been pretty good, yes.
I should let you put the finishing touches on that blade there.
All right. So now what I'm doing basically is we've ground the edges, so now there's a burr on the edge. So what I'm doing here, and if you feel this, it's very rough. You can feel how sharp it is. This is one of the problems that you get when you take your skates into somebody to sharpen, is after they grind it, they don't take this off. And that is so extremely sharp that if you try to stop, it just digs in and you end up on your nose, because the blade stops instantly and it does not slide. So this is it's a real good indicator of somebody that doesn't really know what they're doing.
Are there Bob Beyers in other cities?
Well, I don't know if they're quite as good looking, but I suppose there are here and there. There are other people, very definitely. And there's some that are very good, and there's others that are not. And I've seen, it's like I get skates from everywhere. There's a guy, Jan the Skate Man, who is up in Wisconsin Rapids. I've never met the man, but I've seen a lot of his work. He's usually very, very good in as far as getting the edges square. When I see him mount blades, they're usually it looks very good. He's actually been one of my favorite people, that if I see his stuff, it's like, oh, good.
At least you don't have to fix anything.
At least I know I don't have to fix too much.
You explained how you happened to learn to do this. When did people start bringing you their skates?
Well, actually, when I bought the equipment, I never even thought about that. I basically bought the equipment to sharpen my skates because I knew how important it was. So after my old coach told me about it and showed me how to use it and everything, and I took the equipment, he said, hey, you know, a lot of other people come to me and ask me to get skates sharpened. Is it okay if I send them to you? And I said, well, I never thought about it. If they don't mind a rookie sharpener, yeah, okay, fine. So that's how it started. And then as time went on, I kept getting better and better and more proficient. Where you see me now, it takes maybe, you know, 5 to 10 minutes to sharpen a pair of skates, depending. In those days, sometimes it would take me 45 minutes to do one pair.
Let me ask you a really sensitive question here. Which is worse? Somebody brings you a skate that's been really poorly sharpened the last time, or someone who brings you a skate that really smells bad?
Well, I don't know. I guess I've gotten used to the smell. Mine weren't too good smelling either, so I guess maybe that kind of got me there. But yeah, definitely. I hate to see bad sharpenings. And you see people struggling so much, and you know, I mean, you can tell just by watching them skate when they do a good jump, and they should have landed this and they fell through no fault of their own. And most of the time it falls to the sharpening, and it's awful hard to land jumps when you have no edges.
So when you see or you hear about someone whose skates you've sharpened, you know, doing well in a competition or what have you, does it make you happy? Does it give you a sense of satisfaction?
It's very gratifying. I love to go and watch the kids compete and test, because that's where the rubber meets the road. Let's face it. All I want to know is that I'm giving them the best opportunity that I can in order to attain their goals, you know, to pass that test or, you know, get to the next level, whatever it is.
Do you anticipate that someday you will be teaching this to another person to carry it on?
Yes, absolutely. Hopefully, you know, nothing happens to me that I can't do that, but I definitely would like to pass it on to somebody so that at least the skaters in this area will always have somebody that, you know, if they choose to get their skates done, they can go to somebody that knows what they're doing and can do it well. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Bob Beyer, I think you have given a lot of people a new appreciation for what they're going to see during the Winter Olympics or whenever they watch skating or whenever they go skating themselves. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I love doing this for the skaters. Like I say, it's like an extended family for me.
Bob Beyer has sharpened thousands of skates for thousands of skaters in the Milwaukee area. We visited him in his workshop in Milwaukee, and you can see pictures of him at work at WUWM.com.
Incidentally, if the Olympics have you itching to watch figure skating in person, there will be plenty of local talent on view this Sunday when the Pettit National Ice Center hosts its annual Snow Crystals competition.
We'll take one more break, and then two Milwaukee musicians share the spotlight in an interview and performance in our Studio C1. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The music industry can be a hyper-competitive place, but local musicians Kaylee Conway and Marielle Allschwang are proof it can also be a place that breeds creative friendships.
Although the two musicians perform with different groups, they share a sense of camaraderie and a desire to create and explore. That's perhaps best exemplified by Conway lending her own guitar to Allschwang partway through their conversation in the Lake Effect Performance Studio.
The two performers not only shared a guitar, but will share a double bill this Friday at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point, and they joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in studio recently to share some music with us. This is Kaylee Conway with her song, As Long As It's a Secret.
Everywhere I go, I will bring him for belonging. Well, sudden, for some reason, quit.
As long as it's a secret from Kaylee Conway, she is here live in the Lake Effect studio along with Marielle Allschwang, or Allschwang.
Yeah, go for it. Allschwang, let's do it.
All right. Thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
At the same time, that was good.
Jinx, you can't speak for the rest of the interview.
So this is kind of a pared down set for you guys. You guys are more used to playing with at least a few other folks and electric guitars. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely started on acoustic, and electric has been more of a transition that I've been going through lately. But I have always kind of consistently played inconsistently with a group. So it's not really anything new for me to like have an acoustic rendition and sit here by myself and play. Although I've never done a radio performance by myself before.
Oh.
Yeah. First time. Yes and no. Yes.
Yeah, same here. First radio solo iteration. But yeah, this is where it all starts. I'll be playing the guitar that I wrote this song on. That's one of the songs on. Oh, thanks.
Mm-hmm. So you're both Milwaukee-based musicians, and it is a smaller city with a more intimate community of musicians. You know, what do you like about working in a city like Milwaukee? And you know, what would you change if you could?
Great question.
Yeah.
I like feeling as though I've built relationships with, like, almost everyone, kind of. I know there's still a lot of people and styles of music to yet explore, but so I've been playing out in Milwaukee for probably like 8 or 9 years or something, and you know, it's taken about that long, but now I feel like I know everyone, if that gives you any scope. And I'm sure in a bigger city there would still be like a lot of different scenes and pockets that like are further than 6 degrees separate from me and what I do, but it's not uncommon to have someone in your band who's in another band, or in a band with someone who's in a band that's music that you would never otherwise have listened to.
Mm-hmm. I think music is a huge reason I'm still here. I'm from Milwaukee originally, and I came back as a sort of newly committed musician. I left to study art, and I came back after writing some songs and started playing them out. And then I met some folks from the band group of the Altos, which was at that time like a 12-piece and expanded into like a 19-piece. But that's where I met everybody that I play in bands with now, pretty much. And just in that one pocket, I guess, everybody has so many treasures to share that you can contribute to or explore with them. And I think in addition to that, from my experience, Milwaukee is unique in that there's a sort of like a protective umbrella of like self-assurance, or like a permission to experiment or really speak from your own voice, mm-hmm. that I think is really unique to hear. And like I said, my experience with that band and the bands I've been in since and the projects that I've been a part of since, and also El Verno Presents, which doesn't exist anymore, but there was just a Guthrie Uncovered show, and those Uncovered shows came from El Verno Presents, but that was also very unique to Milwaukee and very unique to, I think, the national landscape of the performing arts. They presented all these sort of specially curated shows, things that you kind of couldn't see anywhere else, but you had a chance to really fail with something, some crazy idea that you had. Not crazy, usually brilliant, but but you know, there's not a lot of places where you give yourself permission to be that wildly experimental, I think. And then you get to do it with people that you love and have known forever.
With that idea of space for exploration, how do you think your sound has changed as you've been playing in Milwaukee with different groups, with different people, exploring maybe different instruments?
A lot. And I would say that a lot of that has to do with what Marielle was saying about, Milwaukee, I think, does kind of embrace experimental sounds. It's not necessarily like a race to hit the mainstream charts, at least not in my experience. But my style and compositions have changed so much by being exposed to the people who I've been fortunate enough to play with, whether in my own project or things that I've been involved in. And kind of the switch over to electric guitar has led my compositions in much more experimental directions, because I realize there's a lot more that I can do with my instrument and more sounds I can contribute to the pieces, but they're not necessarily in the conventional, like, I'm going to play blues chords and then a solo in this one section. So, yes, feeling facilitated in playing electric guitar and by bandmates who play, you know, arguably much more experimental music than I do, has allowed me to branch out a lot from, you know, when I started, I was pretty comfortable within, like, just a folk realm, playing chords and hoping that other people would really make my music what it needed to be, like, for me. And now I feel like I can do more of that myself, but I have to use more of the experimental voice that I have, because otherwise the self-expression is diluted somewhat.
Nice. What was the question again?
I'm sorry.
No worries. You know, I have another question for you. You have you kind of branched out into music videos with your piece Aquarium, mm-hmm. which was featured at last year's Milwaukee Film Festival. What does the visual element, the video part, add to the experience of your music that it might not have had without that?
I think it's just another language to enhance or complicate or, like, sort of draw out the nuances of something that a thought or a series of thoughts you had, you know, that you maybe didn't even know how to translate except through that set of words and through that melody. So, you know, after some time, Heather, who directed the video, we got together and she had certain ideas having to do with cinematograph techniques and certain images, and so I knew right away that they would resonate with this song and the lyrics and the pacing of it. But the really cool thing is, and I don't know if this happens all the time, it was just kind of this serendipitous stroke of synergy. I don't know.
Synergy.
But it was a really amazing opportunity to create something that could delve even deeper into those ideas. It's a visual language and a language of time.
Marielle, so what's interesting, when I was looking through your stuff, you've really embraced legacy recording mediums. Dead Not Done came out on cassette, came out on vinyl.
Same album.
Same
different
album.
Iterations. Different
Once
iteration. The cassettes were sold out, it was only digital. I wanted that baby on vinyl.
On vinyl, yeah.
I was trying to think of a cool
wax.
On wax, that's the word I was looking for.
That is cool.
Moments lost. Sorry.
What do you find compelling about these vintage mediums? What is it about them?
I think they all have a different texture. Maybe that can be recreated digitally now, but as someone who thrives off of textural experiences, I like the tactility. And why not have a beautiful object? I don't know. I'm not a big digital music listener. I have to admit, also, since my computer crashed, I have pretty much two albums to my name. So, but the cassette iteration of the album was also partly a coincidence of having it released on Gloss Records, which is really into, I don't know if they do anymore, but they usually put out albums on cassette tape first. And then after that, I had a chance to put it out on vinyl and, like, really do all the things that I always wanted to do for putting on an album. So yeah, that's kind of why everything I've ever listened to also has been on vinyl. Like when you're a kid, going, Kaylee's looking at me like, yeah.
It yeah. seems like you don't have physical copies of your albums.
Right now, I don't. I've always done disc, but I've only released two physical things. There's an EP and a full-length, both that I did with my old band, the Lucy Cukes. And I'm sold out of both of them as of pretty recently. And yeah, I would love to press vinyl, but I'm not going to make that my first priority until there's like a clear kind of business reason to do it, or that like if it seems like the investment is going to make a return. Because at this point, nothing that I've ever really put money down for musically has come back to me in full. Okay. So I'm trying to be very conscious of that going forward. And it's hard for me not to feel a little lost, you know, like, I don't have any merch right now, but am I going to spend the money to get CDs pressed? Because now CDs are really going out of vogue, and, you know, cars and computers aren't being made with CD players. So it's more like a big, inconvenient business card to give someone. But then if you try to transfer your digital merchandise to them, it's a lot more talking in words, like, oh, go to this website, or I'll send you a link. And I don't know who is downloading stuff from Bandcamp. I don't think that's a huge thing. So I've just recently started doing streaming, which I don't really know how I feel about that. But it's very the opposite of what you were saying, Marielle, about like being very loyal to the more vintage listening mediums.
Yeah, and it's not even really loyalty to the medium. It's more going back to what I was saying with music videos, for instance. It was kind of more an opportunity to be more intentional and specific about what kinds of conversations you want to have between different images and words and colors. And that's something that I didn't really have an opportunity to really play up yet. And for this album especially, it felt meaningful to me. But yeah, for sure, like if it wasn't something that I felt would enhance or communicate something from me, then I don't think I would have bothered just to have an object out in the world.
Yeah. Well, the cool thing about tape and vinyl is that people do intentionally collect that stuff. So you can not only have an extension of your expression through the art that you put on it and how you arrange it, but like it's going to transfer to someone who actually really wants it.
Well, and with kind of intentional listening, I saw your Instagram post, because being a producer is essentially being like a Facebook stalker, but you get paid. And I saw your Instagram post, and you specifically said, you posted a photo of your Spotify account.
Yeah.
And you said, like, don't shuffle. Please don't shuffle.
Yeah.
I've heard this before from artists. Why do you hate the shuffle?
I really hate the shuffle. I do. And I hate it because, you know, I think any musician who's composed an album will tell you that, like, the flow of it is so important, like, to them. You know, it's, like, as important as choosing what picture is going to go on it, or doing the art for it, or the song titles. And the stuff I've released hasn't been very tightly conceptual as far as, like, the range of concept albums go. So it's not like you're really going to get lost in a narrative. But it's, you know, we do so much to make things super easy on the listener and convenient, and I think it's often at the artist's expense, you know, whether it's a streaming service or just like cheap, easy lyrics or whatever. So I think it's really important to like stand firm, hold your ground as an artist with kind of what you're saying and how you're saying it. And the more people who can get privy to that, the better, I think. Also, the way I've always listened to albums has been a very album-by-album experience, and those song sequences have become really special and kind of ingrained in me. And when I hear one end, I'm kind of like ready to dive into the next one. I think it's really important for the end song to be the end song, or even if it's going to be on repeat, for the end to kind of lead back into the first one. I also just felt it necessary to mention the shuffle thing because, like, the screenshot that I posted had a giant shuffle button.
Yeah.
'Cause that's the first thing that Spotify tells you to do. You know, I think they know their listeners really well. They know the attention span, so they feed them the most popular track. And they say, go ahead, shuffle. Don't think about it.
On the thought of kind of concept albums, Marielle, you're working on a song cycle. Is that right?
That's correct, Joy. Yeah, I'm writing songs in response to the artist environment of Mary Knoll. Her environment is still in Fox Point. Many of you listening may be familiar with her work. And if you're not, I do encourage you to check it out. So I'm really excited about that.
Kaylee, what do you have coming up?
Well, I am in the kind of mixing stages of an EP that I recorded with my trio at a good friend's studio called The Chair Company in Bayview. And I mean, like anything, and I knew it would, it's just taken a lot longer than like the time frame that I had budgeted for it. But I'm really excited about it because it's a batch of new songs, and I feel like I really got to like cut loose on the guitar. It's mainly an electric guitar album. Parts of it get decently rocky, and then there's also like a lot of weirdness that goes on, and I just felt really like able to put it all out on the table, and I'm very excited about it. Should come out within the next couple months.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing it.
Thanks.
So we have one more song from Marielle, Drifting.
Yep.
Drifting, drifting, reading the road, drawing lacing lines.
Kaylee Conway and Marielle Alschwang are both Milwaukee-based musicians. They'll both be featured in a performance at Anodyne Coffee in Walker's Point tomorrow. There's more information at WUWM.com, and our interview was engineered by Jason Reavy. That is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.
All my breath was pulled.